Well, it's down to Donald Trump. I'm Bill Radke, and welcome to KUOW's The Record. Today, John Kasich's advisors said Kasich will drop out of the Republican presidential campaign. Last night, Ted Cruz suspended his campaign. Cruz's announcement came as news to the head of the Washington State Cruz campaign. Mercer Island resident Saul Gammerin told me he was not expecting Cruz to withdraw, but that Kasich's dropping out, that's a non-event.
It is no relevance. I mean, whether he stays in or drops out, he was a dead man walking months ago, so I don't think it affects anything.
How did you react when your man with Ted Cruz dropped out?
Oh, I was disappointed and surprised. He was coming here today. We had a day and a half of a tremendous rally set up across the state from Bothell to Spokane to Vancouver, and we had a big fundraiser tonight, and we were very excited about it, and so naturally we were disappointed when we heard the news.
Ted Cruz will not be coming to Washington State now. You are left in an awkward position. You have said you're not a fan of Donald Trump, so what do you do now?
Well, I don't feel like I'm in an awkward position. I'm an American. I have values, and I was proud to support Ted Cruz, and he did the best he could. We did the best we could. We think we would have gotten a terrific result here in our state. We certainly did a great. We're very successful in the delegate campaign, and we have a large majority of delegates going to Pasco, preparing to send a delegation to Cleveland. So I don't feel awkward at all. I just feel disappointed and tired.
I'm wondering about what you do now in this presidential election, presumably between Hillary Clinton and a man you've said you do not support, the Republican presumptive nominee. So what do you do next?
Well, I would say this. I certainly couldn't support Trump. He doesn't represent my values. And really, that's as far as I've gotten at this point. You know, I'm not trying to be coy. I just haven't thought it through past the fact that I could never support Donald Trump. And, you know, I suppose there are some Cruz supporters that would support Donald Trump, but I've never met any of them.
Is there anything Hillary Clinton could do to earn your vote?
Nothing crosses, nothing occurs to me at the moment. But, now this is probably in the category of, it's been less than 24 hours, and the idea, that question really hadn't been posed to me before because it was kind of, would have thought of silly. You know, I think in this situation, I'm not the first to go through it. The main thing is to take a breath, get some sleep, rest, and contemplate. But she doesn't represent my views either.
Are you sure, Saul, that there's no Washington State Ted Cruz campaign for you to head up? I mean, people have long talked about a contested convention. The Republican Party doesn't seem to support Trump. So is there still a Cruz campaign? It's just suspended maybe until the convention?
Well, if that's the case, it's news to me, but I don't think that's being realistic. I think that the idea of a contested convention is simply that we strongly believe as Americans in majority rule. And no matter what Trump would whine about it, he needed 1,237 delegates. And the fact is, he's going to have those delegates before the convention. So I can't predict what's going to be happening in Cleveland, but I've seen nothing from the Cruz campaign indicating they're going to put up some sort of a fight. Again, Ted Cruz is a strong believer in supporting the Constitution and the democratic process. So I don't think he's going to be involved in some sort of a plot to defy the will of the American people. I think that's what he said last night.
But what about Ted Cruz running as an independent?
Oh, I've seen no interest in that, and I think he fought hard for the Republican nomination, and I think that he belongs to the Republican Party. I think what he tried to do was to keep our party from being hijacked, and he was not successful in doing that.
You don't like Clinton, you don't like Trump. Could you imagine yourself supporting or even getting involved in some kind of third party campaign?
I don't. I think it's unrealistic at this point that a third party candidate could have any kind of campaign. Look, you had a fellow with $30 billion, Michael Bloomberg, looked at it, and he didn't think it was feasible. So I think it's fair to say it's not feasible. So I think the candidates and the choices are going to be Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And people, myself included, are going to have to reconcile ourselves to that. and do the best we can. We have three choices. We can vote for one, vote for the other, or register our opinion by not voting. Those are the choices.
Saul Gammarin is Washington State Chair of Senator Ted Cruz's campaign, such as it is. Cruz had planned to campaign here this week, but he suspended things last night after losing yesterday's Indiana primary to Donald Trump. Now, as I said, John Kasich is also reportedly dropping out today. Kasich had wide support here in Washington among our state's mainstream elected Republicans. His campaign co-chairs here included former Governor Dan Evans, former U.S. Senator Slade Gorton, and former Attorney General Rob McKenna, who told us how he sees likely Republican nominee Donald Trump.
Well, it's bad for the Republican Party establishment, of which I'm a card-carrying member, because Trump came in and, as we see it, hijacked our party. But what really happened, if you step away from it and look at it more objectively, is that a whole lot of voters who might not have voted in the Republican primary at all were attracted to Trump because of his strong anti-establishment message. And I think what that really amounts to is a whole lot of folks in this country who support Trump and another group who support Sanders, who are very unhappy with the direction of the country, and they want to fire the establishment. They want to fire the Clintons. They want to fire everyone associated with the Republican establishment in D.C., and that is what Trump embodies for them. He has tapped into a deep wellspring of discontent that running things in D.C. right now really appreciated before.
Lots of us are used to a president and a nominee who we don't see completely eye to eye with. How not okay are you with Donald Trump?
Well, I can't support Trump. I think he's a demagogue and an opportunist with no real foundation in principles or values that I can detect. So I'll probably write in John Kasich as my candidate for president when I vote.
Are you telling your fellow Republicans, you and your many other Kasich supporters, the moderate Washington Republican faction, is this the plan, is to write in John Kasich?
Well, I would like to see lots of my fellow Republicans do that. John Kasich would beat Hillary Clinton if they squared off in November. And more and more, it looks like the Cleveland convention is going to end up being a political Jonestown where, you know, the Trump delegates drink the Kool-Aid and then die politically, because he can't win. He's going to be slaughtered by Clinton in November, and it could cost us races down ballot as well. The only reason I can see that we won't have that kind of effect down ballot in our races for Senate and Congress and local races is that Trump does seem to be turning people out to vote who were otherwise not participating. The question is, will they vote for other Republicans on the ballot, number one? And number two, will Republican turnout be affected, you know, the base Republican vote, the people who consider themselves, members of the Republican Party? And that is now it's just too early to say.
So you're still supporting Kasich, but you could argue Kasich has proven he can't win either. So are you basically writing off this election? Are you saying, hey, we cannot let Trump be the nominee and we need a third party or some other more drastic solution? What are you working at right now?
A third party is not a realistic option. It would not have been a realistic option for Trump if, you know, he fell short. It's not a realistic option for Governor Kasich or anyone else. It's too late to qualify to get on the ballots in too many states as an independent candidate or a third-party candidate. So that just isn't realistic. So I think that if Trump is the nominee, what the Republicans will end up doing is focusing in the Senate, congressional, state legislative races, and other races at a more local level, which we've seen happen before when it was obvious that Senator Dole would not defeat Bill Clinton when President Clinton was running for re-election. The way that down-ballot damage was limited was by focusing on the local issues in those races, and that actually worked quite well in that election.
In one sense, Donald Trump did his job. He said what it took to become, probably, apparently, the Republican nominee. How do you know that Trump doesn't now pivot? General election time, he moderates his views, you know, he's hiring advisors. And are you sure Donald Trump can't be not your guy, but someone who could be president?
Well, I think it just is extremely unlikely that he can win in November, given how far behind he is, how high his negatives are, particularly with women voters. Having said that, I hope that he pivots enough to limit the damage that could be done to the Republican Party going forward and to our candidates down ballot from him.
Let's talk about that damage. The head of the Republican National Committee, Reince Priebus, says in a tweet, "We all need to unite and focus on defeating Clinton." There's your party, Rob McKenna. Do you and all the many moderate Washington Republicans like you, do you need a new party?
No, I don't think so. I think this is like confusing climate with weather. You don't want to confuse one election with, you know, what's going on as a long-term trend. But I do think this is a pivotal moment in the Republican Party's history. I think that Senator Cruz's inability to finish this campaign and be competitive for the nomination indicates that the Reagan-Goldwater era of the party is coming to a close, because it just doesn't have broad enough appeal. Even though I'm a Reagan Republican, I see the handwriting on the wall. And it means the party needs to morph into something that has a broader appeal to voters of color, to women voters, to younger voters especially. And I think that can happen. I think that over time that will happen. But it doesn't necessarily happen overnight. Recall how many elections for president the Democratic Party lost in the 70s and 80s until Bill Clinton kind of yanked them back towards the center with the group that he formed. And, of course, we have to remember that this is a dynamic situation. Things are changing on the Democratic side of the aisle as well. Bernie Sanders has, and his supporters have pulled the Democratic Party to the left. The center of gravity in that party has shifted left, probably too far left for the comfort of a lot of voters, which is why Governor Kasich would win, I think, if he were up against Hillary Clinton in November. So it's a dynamic situation, and I don't think you can predict the long-term future based on a single election.
That is former Washington State Attorney General Rob McKenna. He's been a co-chair with the Washington Kasich campaign here in Washington. Says he's not going to vote for Trump. He's still a Republican. He's not going to vote for a Democrat. He's going to write in John Kasich and focus on helping his kind of Republicans get elected to Congress. By the way, even though Trump is now the apparent Republican nominee, there is still a Washington Republican primary. Ballots for it start going out in the mail today, and you've got until May 24th to return your ballot. Donald Trump's campaign has said he might come and campaign in Washington State. We don't know whether that still goes now that his competitors have dropped out. This is KUOW's The Record. KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to the program. Effective this month, tattoo enthusiasts who serve in the U.S. Navy can ink a lot more of their bodies. The Navy's latest policy change is an effort to remain attractive to millennials who might be excluded from serving because of the size of their artwork. KUOW's Patricia Murphy reports on military affairs.
When the submarine, the USS Toledo, pulled into Connecticut's Naval Base New London last week, tattoo artist Adam Hillier's phone started ringing.
Thanks for your tattoo company. This is Adam.
After spending weeks at sea, there's a naval tradition that sailors add a new tattoo to their collection.
They do generally gravitate toward tattoos that can be done in one sitting.
But not everyone. Some sailors like body art that makes a bigger statement.
So I can do a little tune-up before I do the actual tattoo.
In the chair today, Navy Petty Officer First Class Mike Spittler. Spittler already has a nautical scene with Poseidon, the god of the sea, tattooed on his right arm from his shoulder to his wrist. Today, Hillier is shading in an ornate caricature of a fortune teller on Spittler's left arm. The piece is large enough that the fortune teller has her own tattoos.
Yeah, well, it's a black and gray piece, but her tattoos are blue, so they stand out on her.
Tattoos are such a big part of Spittler's lifestyle that he's not just a client here. He actually owns this place, which he balances with his shore duty in the Navy.
You ready, ma'am?
Yep.
The Navy's policy change allows Spittler and other sailors to get more tattoos and larger ones. Tattoos can now extend below the elbow and knee, and for the first time, sailors can have tattoos up to an inch on their necks. At the Office of Navy Personnel, Lieutenant Commander Nate Christensen says the Pentagon's commitment to professional appearance hasn't changed, but young people have. He says strict tattoo limits made it hard to recruit.
This policy change really is about being honest with ourselves and ultimately putting policies in place that reflect tattoo realities across America. We have the most talented sailors we've ever had in the Navy, but this is also about looking forward and making sure that our recruiting and retention numbers are as good in future as they are today.
Of course, while millennials are getting more tattoos, body art is nothing new in the Navy. Here at the Puget Sound Navy Museum in Bremerton, Washington, there's a whole exhibit devoted to maritime tattoo history. Curator Megan Churchwell traces it back to the 1700s.
You would use the big needles that you used to sew a ship's sail, and then you dip it in the ink and then poke it into the skin.
At the time, tattoos were more practical than decorative, a sailor's initials and maybe his birth date so his body could be identified if he died at sea.
This was on a ship using unsterilized materials that you just had on board with you. It was a very painful process.
There were few formal content restrictions until 1909, when the Navy issued the first regulations against obscene tattoos. From that point forward, the voluptuous bodies on pin-up girl tattoos had to be clothed just enough to get by. Still, Navy policy has always been subjective. When Spittler joined, some of his tattoos were already bigger than regulations allowed.
I was required to go and sit down in front of a pretty high-ranking officer at the time when I was doing my initial contract and my paperwork, and just explain to them the meaning behind all of my tattoos. The big things that they're kind of concerned with at that time was that they weren't writing waivers for tattoos that were possibly gang-related or had some kind of negative meaning behind them.
Spittler is happy to see the regulations loosened. He says there's no reason to exclude people from jobs simply because of their body art, even if they have as much as he has, both legs, his right arm, and now his new fortune teller ink on his left arm.
Eventually, this whole arm is going to have to do with my family. So at the top, it just made sense to have something that represented good fortune.
Even with the Navy's changes, some tattoos are still taboo. No head tattoos, no symbols of gangs or extremist groups, and no obscenity. Tattoo regulations in other service branches haven't changed. I'm Patricia Murphy, KUOW News.
You can find that story along with photos at our website, KUOW.org.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. A few months ago, three teenage boys shot five people in the homeless encampment called The Jungle. The Jungle has been around for decades, but you only tend to hear about it when something awful happens. KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols wanted to know whether the reality of The Jungle matched up with all the stories. So he's been visiting. I asked him what he found.
There's a lot of different kinds of people there. I want to introduce you now to one guy who he's an interesting character. He keeps his camp meticulously clean, and his most prized possession is a bag full of harmonicas. I'm going to let him introduce himself. You're also going to hear the voice of an outreach worker, Liz Curtis, who goes out with this group called Heroes for the Homeless and distributes food out there.
Do you mind giving me your actual name then?
Jacobo Miguel Piñon Jr.
A couple weeks ago, he asked for a CD of Disney songs so that he could learn them on the harmonica.
And I started playing every one of their songs, and I love every one of them. I got all the keys, A through G, and whatever song comes on, F, E, sometimes you got to take two or three of them, and I play.
Does music bring people together out here at all?
It brings me together. It keeps me away from all that mind-altering stuff.
And Joshua, why did you want to introduce us to this man?
Okay, because we know the jungle's dangerous, right? But this guy shows how that danger sometimes fades into the background for a lot of people who live here. And sometimes it even gives way to moments of levity, like with the harmonicas.
So we hear so much about how scary and dangerous the jungle is. What surprised you the most about the place when you first went in there?
Well, I learned how big it is. It's not just this one encampment. It's just a whole bunch of different, almost like neighborhoods. It's about 3 miles long. It takes about 45 minutes to walk from one end to the other. Parts of it are well connected, but some other parts are relatively isolated from each other. I learned how normal it can start to feel after a while, especially the noise, the constant noise, the pounding of cars against the expansion joints. It can start to sound almost like a river after a while. I had many people there tell me that. And then also the value of space. There's so much space there, space to put your belongings. And for a lot of people who live there, the jungle represents a way to graduate from basically a nomadic life where you're pushing stuff around in a shopping cart or carrying it with you because you can't leave it in most of the shelters, to a life of consistency and permanence.
Well, permanence. This is the question. What to do with the jungle now, especially ever since the shooting that happened in January? We've had the city and the people who live there talking, arguing about what we ought to do with this space. And we've heard on KUOW from some listeners about this. Here are just a couple of opinions about what ought to be done.
There are so many good-hearted people in the Seattle area. It seems to me that something could be done to help people who at least need to establish who they are, and then perhaps they may be able to get work and perhaps work their way out of the jungle or help other people in the jungle so it would be more habitable or safer.
That was a KUOW listener named Marie Phillips, and we also heard this.
I'd like to see the jungle cleared out, completely razed to the ground, burn everything out, every person, every encampment, all the filth and garbage. That's what needs to happen. Time to get this jungle under control. City is being destroyed. F these people.
And that was a listener named Bob from Seattle. So talk about strong reactions that this brings up in the city. How does the city, Joshua, reconcile such strong, such different, such opposite reactions?
Well, it's easy to want to come up with a blanket solution, to want to just sweep the problem under the rug. But each person in the jungle brings a slightly different set of barriers to turning their life around. And while it's hard to generalize about the people there, you can say that the people in the jungle are resistant to regimentation. That's one thing you can say. The system of homeless services doesn't seem to work for them. And I think in Seattle, we struggle to balance compassion and frustration when it comes to homelessness. Those different approaches that we heard in the listeners' comments are also reflected in our policies. I've been talking with Scott Lindsay in the mayor's office. He's one of the people who is specializing in this area of how to respond to homelessness. And he says they're working on this idea about what to do in the jungle. And it still has to be negotiated with the county and the state, who are also partners in this process. It's state land. But Lindsay wants to put, at least he's telling me now, he wants to put gates, I would assume locked gates, at 10 major intersections where homeless people and service providers access the jungle along the west side of the jungle. And those gates would knit together the existing fences that are at the back of businesses there and recycling plants and stuff like that. And then on the other hand, they want to flood the area with cops and service providers because they know that just because they kind of wall off one part of it doesn't mean that people won't still camp there. So on the one hand, they're talking about a fence, a partial fence. And on the other side, they're talking about outreach. You can hear the echoes of both of those listener comments in that two-part approach, the carrot and the stick. We don't know enough about this plan yet to know how much carrot and how much stick they're going to use. We've got about $1 million of state money for cleanup and safety in the jungle. And in the coming weeks, we'll get more information about what the city, the county, and the state want to do with that money and how it's all going to work.
Following the jungle for you and all the issues around it, KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols. Joshua, thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
All this month, KUOW will be bringing you to the jungle. You'll hear from the people who live there and about the challenges the jungle poses and what we should do about it. You can hear Joshua's reporting. You can see photos of the jungle all at our website, KUOW.org. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Today is First Wednesday, which means tomorrow, this is way more exciting, tomorrow's First Thursday, the day when Seattle's galleries and museums open their doors to the public for free. Among all the great options for affordable art viewing in Seattle this month, Stranger art critic Jen Graves says one show at the Fry Art Museum is the best exhibition she's seen in Seattle in a long time. The name of the show is Youngblood, and it presents video and paintings by two brothers from Seattle, Noah Davis and Khalil Joseph. Graves told Jeannie Andel a little of their backstory.
They grew up mostly in Mount Baker, and they went to school in O'Day, and they've known another artist in town, Makoyo Ali Barnes, since they were kids. Makoyo Ali Barnes is the curator of this exhibition at the Fry, and they are incredibly important because they are part of a long line of Black artistic production in Seattle that is tremendously fruitful and that we often don't recognize here
one of the brothers in this exhibition, Khalil Joseph, he's got kind of another career now, or at least he's known for something else. He was one of the directors for Lemonade, which is Beyoncé's visual album. So as an artist, who is Khalil Joseph?
Vice magazine asks, like, is Khalil Joseph the greatest hip-hop director? You know, and I think he's far more than a hip-hop director. I think he's a total artist. He just is an artist in film. A new work in this exhibition is a three-sided cinema that takes images from a town that has an all-black rodeo and that was originally founded as an all-black town in Oklahoma. And so it's similar to, I mean, Davida Ingram wrote a piece for The Stranger in which he called Beyoncé's work a sort of a kaleidoscopic view of blackness. And Khalil Joseph's work is much the same. There's, you know, country, R&B, hip-hop, you know, soul. I mean, it's really very multifaceted and throughout time, right? It's really melding all kinds of time.
As you pointed out, the show at the Fry features the work of two brothers. Noah Davis is the other brother. What is Noah Davis's work like?
Noah Davis makes paintings in bright colors that often feature single individuals in sort of mysterious situations, sometimes kind of mythic. There's a large painting at the beginning of the exhibition that's a man sort of peering out into an abyss, and you see him from the back. And it's a painting, it's called Painting for My Dad, and his father was dying at the time. And it's just this kind of gorgeous meditation on looking out and into the space, but not being able to see his face, you know, just seeing his body language. He accomplishes quite a lot of mystery in a single scene. There's another work called Isis where he paints his wife, Karan, as Isis, the goddess. And she's also standing sort of on the side of, like, at the side of the house next to, like, a discarded heating vent on the, you know, on the lawn. And so there are these gorgeous, gorgeous paintings, and they really are just multivalent. I mean, you look at them and they just keep on giving and giving and giving, which is similar to Khalil Joseph's work. There is a third artist in this show, I should mention. It's not actually a person, but is listed as the third artist. And it's important to the curator that we talk about it that way, which is the Underground Museum, which is a museum that the two brothers founded in L.A. in a part of the city that didn't have any museums. And it's free and it's ongoing. And it has a partnership now with LA MoCA to show their work on loan. So it's become sort of a satellite.
Noah Davis actually died recently of cancer. Mm-hmm. How does that show up in this exhibition?
Mm. That's a great question. Noah Davis's death shows up in this exhibition in a really subtle way. There's one room in the center of the exhibition that's essentially a memorial chapel, as it were. There are benches. There's a huge garden, mostly populated with purple plants. And the Northwest is really, really full of purple plants. I've noticed this since I've had it pointed out to me with this exhibition. And he grew up around these plants and then actually created this purple garden at the Underground Museum that he created in L.A. And then the Fry has created it here in fake plants. And at one end of the room is the earliest painting from the exhibition from 2008. At the other is the latest. So it's sort of a room with his bookending his life. And it's, you know, it kind of handles the death in a really enclosed way so that you can consider all of his work and not just in the context of his death.
What is it like to see the work of these two brothers, Khalil Joseph and Noah Davis? What's it like to see their work together in the same space?
Oh, it's electric. It's really, really fantastic. I mean, there are actually not that many works in the show. I mean, it's not jammed. You know, I mean, Noah Davis left behind, I think, like 200 paintings. He often painted over paintings, really finished paintings, just went back and painted them over. And there's a documentary that Khalil and Nicole Otero and another person whose name I'm forgetting made of Noah at work in this exhibition. So this is an important part of the show. And you go and you can see him at work and it's heartbreaking, right? He walks up to these canvases, we just start covering them over again. Yeah. So in these paintings, there are layers and layers of paintings. But just to see those works together, I mean, Khalil's works are like fireworks. I mean, they are so rich. And Noah's works really kind of come alive
next to Khalil's works, as in filmic, become filmic. And they look like scenes from an ongoing story. And then Khalil's works look painterly, right? There, you just notice the visuals are stunning and so complexly created. I mean, really. And anybody who's seen Lemonade, I was shocked because I watched Lemonade and, you know, I had heard that a whole bunch of directors worked on it. But Khalil Joseph is the only person who's listed on the first page of directors in those credits. It says, directed by Khalil Joseph, Beyoncé Knowles Carter. And then there's another slide. I mean, like, he's the mastermind behind the visuals on that work. And it's just, his work is so layered. It's so layered. And it's beautiful to watch. Somehow, these artists manage to make works that you absolutely want to watch and that have absolute integrity. That's actually really difficult to do. They have commercial appeal somehow. And also, they're just, you can learn a lot from them. And also, I think they're specifically made to address a range of Black experience for a Black audience, like Beyoncé's videos. Like, those videos aren't made for me. I'm a white woman, you know? And I look at them in order to learn and enjoy the gorgeousness of that and the richness. And it's spectacular to see the Fry, a free museum, doing this show.
And that's Jen Graves telling you about it, art critic for The Stranger, talking with Jeannie Yandel about this show, Youngblood, now at the Fry Art Museum, downtown Seattle, until June 19th. By the way, Jen said, if you only do one thing, you should watch Belhaven Meridian. That is Khalil Joseph's music video with the local group Shabazz Palaces.
I always saw myself as like, how can I create change? How can I create impact? How can I speak for myself? How can I speak in order to call attention to the voices that are never heard?
That is Seattle's Hollis Wong Ware. At age 28, she's accomplished a lot. She's a poet, an activist. She's the lead singer of the band The Flavor Blue. And she sang this famous hook on the Macklemore and Ryan Lewis song White Walls. I talked with Hollis Wong Ware about how Seattle has shaped her and why she pushes to change the city she loves so much.
I don't feel like I would be a musician or be an artist, a working artist, if I hadn't been here. Like,
why's
I really,
that?
I feel like at the age of 28 now, I now know how to be in a place like LA with a strong sense of self and a sense of self that is not conditioned upon open doors or closed doors that somebody else controls, or putting myself in a pecking order and feeling like I need to kind of fight my way up a hierarchical sense of like who I am and like what my profile is and where I fit in. You know, I think in Seattle, I was allowed to develop organically and realize that, to really focus on what made me singular. So
that's what I want to know. Is that about starting personal or starting local, or is there something particular about Seattle for you?
The amazing paradox of Seattle is that, you know, in many ways we do have an absence of industry. But on the flip, we've created some of the most important music globally in the last 100 years. Not even created, but just nurtured. And I just feel like, you know, that nurturing element of Seattle's culture and artistic community is a huge part of why, you know, I feel like I was able to step into the identity of being an artist. I think that it's a fertile land. It almost like is enabled by its isolation, whether that's geographic isolation or industry isolation, but like truly genius work that resonates worldwide. There's like a reason why it was shaped here before it went out. And I love that. I mean, I love being in LA or being on tour with my band and, you know, proudly saying that I'm from Seattle and proudly identifying with this place that I feel has given so much and is in such a period of transition now that it's really important for the inherent and value of art to be, continue to be valued as like a core identity of the city.
I'm talking with Seattle artist, musician Hollis Wong Ware. Besides all your other work, you're also internationally famous. because of your work with Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, my 9-year-old daughter sings, I got that off black Cadillac midnight drive. How has that visibility affected you?
It's hard for me to answer that question because for me, I know, you know, just sheer numbers wise, I know where my voice has touched and my face has reached, and which can be kind of a trip if you start thinking about it like that. I mean, for me, when I think about the experience working with Macklemore and Ryan Lewis on that album, my takeaway or what impacts me is not really like, oh, I'm like so globally recognized now, which I think in the age of the internet, a lot of that is diluted in my head anyway. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Right. We know Rebecca Black and Charlie Bit My Finger, too.
Ah!
Right. It's having people know who you are is not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
But you were saying.
Yeah, no. I mean, I just think of the growth, like the personal growth, you know, and the personal journey. And what an amazing opportunity for me to have worked on that project, which wasn't just like me singing on White Walls, but also was like producing the Thrift Shop video and also like doing a co-write on another song on the album. And I got to kind of flex and grow and strengthen so many of my creative skills. And so that was really a model for me, knowing that like at the end of the day, I'm not interested in being just the voice or just the face. I'm really interested in engaging in what's created in that real process, which is great, because then what I found was when I was like, oh, I can write songs and I can sing songs, and I go to LA and I'm like, oh, okay, actually, like, the power comes in what you create. It's not just singing a nice song. Where the real power lies is in authoring that and shaping that. And so it was a really great affirmation for me as a cultural creator to remember that it's important. At the end of the day, it's fleeting to be a face or fleeting to be a voice, but what you really want to be is like the heart of it. You want to be the words, you want to be the melody, you want to be that thrust, you know?
And you have that body of work, you have that depth of experience, and yet the Seattle Times, knowing, I mean, you're most famous for working with Macklemore, and he's the super, superstar.
Mm-hmm.
The Seattle Times, in a headline, called you Macklemore's sidekick. Mm-hmm. What frustrated you so much about that?
Well, there's a couple of things. So first of all, my band, The Flavor Blue, we've been working together for 3 years. We just released our third project, and our publicist reached out to The Seattle Times, and a Seattle Times editor assigned a writer to our story. And we were thrilled because, of course, like, what a great opportunity, you know, Seattle's premier daily paper to write about our music. It felt like a real accomplishment. And, you know, the writer came through to interview us. Macklemore's name was never evoked throughout the entire interview. It was solely focused on our discography. But I think what was really frustrating to me in that moment was just the gulf between the heart of the article, which really didn't touch on Macklemore at all, and then the way I was labeled and presented through a headline, which was really through like an outside editor that didn't have any, you know, interaction with the content. So I felt like we created this thing that's being communicated, and then it just kind of got the Macklemore like sticker slapped on it on its way out the door. But I think that that's so much of the way we operate as a culture, is like, ooh, who can we get to validate this? This person doesn't have validity on their own. You know, their validity is only contingent and conditional to this centralized figure that we all have a touch point to. So what they would explain was like, oh, you know, we called you Macklemore's sidekick so that more people would read it, which is a complicated thing to say, right? Because what you're saying is that people are only interested in your work if you are conditional to this figure. And then you can go into the analysis.
Couldn't you say that's objectively true, whether we like it or not?
To me, it's like, first of all, if the article had been significantly about our collaborative relationship, I totally would have understood it. There was a true gap between the way that the headline was and then what the article contained, which was actually wholly interested in the work of my band. So I think that, you know, we have to be careful. Again, as an artist, I feel like I have cultural, social agency. Writers, too, have that same agency. They craft the words that we use to communicate and thus shape our realities. And when you do something as simple, you know, and as thoughtless, truly, as calling somebody a sidekick, you are inherently devaluing their agency.
What change do you want to see, or have you seen, through that? That was a pretty public back and forth.
Sure.
Around sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
So What change do you think that has brought about?
It's one of those situations where it's like you look at an institution and you want it to stay relevant and you want it to be on point and you don't want to see it slipping. And it's not something where it's like I find joy in stirring up drama. But I also don't feel like we can let institutions that truly have impact on the way that our society and we as a community within Seattle, as a city, understands itself. Like, you can't let those institutions slide with BS. And if we're not going to speak out about it, it's just going to keep perpetuating itself.
What is it about you that that change is so important to you? Because a lot of us, we just, you know, do our jobs and right, do our thing.
I think that people are sometimes afraid. I don't want to do the wrong thing. I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to look stupid. I'm not a bad person, but it's easier for me to say nothing than to say something. But that's so vain. If you're in a position where you can even choose that option, you have privilege. And how exciting, how like energizing is it to think about activating your privilege? How can I make things happen? It's way more exciting to think about things happening than not, right? One would think. And that's where I, you know, I have a ton of privilege in my life. And for me, it's always about doing that assessment. It's how can I leverage this? Who else can I put on? Like, whether that's literally on a stage as a performer, or who can I have a conversation with and come up with a strategic plan about how that person's work can be, you know, amplified. I'm so motivated by that. I think it's so much more fun. Really, it's fun work. You know what I mean? To work with other people and figure out how you can push the dial forward versus just letting things be chill. Why not be active? It's like CrossFit of the mind and the heart. Yeah, you know, just like, why not push the pedal to the metal? It's about stepping outside oneself and one's pride. Think about, how can I really see where I fit in the grand scheme of things? If I just moved here to Seattle to take a job, what does that really mean in terms of where I sit in the spectrum of the city and its development? And then how can I be an agent of change moving forward versus somebody that just sits by? There's no such thing as like benevolent bystander. Like, I think that silence is an action. Like, and I think that you can choose to be silent, or you can choose to speak up, or to leverage what you have to move towards like a world where all are heard and all are valued.
Hollis Wong Ware, Seattle musician, poet, producer, activist. Her band is called The Flavor Blue. Little of The Flavor Blue on KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. A two-time Olympian living in Seattle is renting out part of his body on eBay to make a point about the earning prospects for elite American runners. It's just the latest move by middle distance runner Nick Simmons to take on his sport's governing boards. KUOW's Tom Bonsi introduces you to the 800-meter champion and his cause.
For my right shoulder, the right deltoid, it's about, I don't know, 10 or 12 square inches, and 9 square inches of that will be covered with a logo of the eBay auction winner.
A temporary tattoo for the outdoor track season, and Nick Simmons is just getting started.
I want to look like a NASCAR out there. I want to have every square inch covered with a logo, and I want to be paid for each square inch of that advertising space.
Now, why would a two-time Olympian resort to selling skin space on eBay? He's done it once before, made over $11,000 with one sponsor before the 2012 London Games, but Simmons has to cover up or remove any individual sponsor logos at track's highest profile events, including the U.S. Olympic Trials and the Summer Games. Only small logos of the team uniform makers allowed.
We still kind of exist under these semi-pro, mostly amateur governing bodies. And basically what they've done is they've confiscated all of the advertising space, and they pimp us out to the highest bidder. And we're lucky if we get a few of the scraps that they toss us at the end of the day.
Simmons acknowledges he's actually luckier than most. He can train full-time for the upcoming Rio Games and doesn't have to work at a second job to make ends meet. But the champion half-miler is driven to change his sport's business model. And the auction of his shoulder space is just one of the means to that end. Simmons makes common cause with college football and basketball players and other competitors.
You also see NCAA, athletes unionizing together and demanding that they control their own name and image, demanding that they receive some of the billions of dollars that are exchanged in events like March Madness and the football playoffs. Mm-hmm. This is the future.
To hasten the future, Simmons launched an antitrust lawsuit this winter against the U.S. Olympic Committee and USA Track and Field. The suit was filed in the name of a caffeinated chewing gum company called Run Gum, co-founded by Simmons and his mentor. The defendants moved to dismiss the lawsuit as groundless. A federal judge in Oregon could rule any day now. The USOC declined an interview request because of the pending litigation, but its legal filings make clear it believes it needs sponsorship exclusivity to generate the revenue to support athlete development and put on competitions. Craig Leone is a professional distance runner as well as manager of the Sports Marketing Master's Program at the University of Oregon School of Business. He says he's not optimistic the sports business model can change quickly short of a judge's order.
I think athletes appreciate what Nick has done. I appreciate what Nick has done. And it takes that kind of a person who's outspoken, who's got a little bravado to be able to do that. But until Nick can rally and galvanize the support of his fellow athletes as a whole, I find it hard to believe that one person can make substantial change.
Is the quad doing all right? Everything looks all right.
Everything feels great.
Simmons trains with the Brooks Beast Track Club in Seattle.
Nice job, guys.
The 32-year-old says it's hard to unionize in what's largely an individual sport. Brooks' teammate Katie Mackey lends her support. Mackey says fewer sponsor restrictions would help track and field to grow.
Loosening these regulations and bringing more money into the sport will make the sport more popular. Because the more people are invested, the more marketing money will go into it.
As the eBay auction ends, Simmons is taking his campaign online under the heading Own Your Skin. He hopes to enlist more Olympians to his cause around the U.S. Olympic trials in Eugene this July. I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
And I'm Bill Radke at KUOW's The Record. When Hollywood studios film outside of California, sometimes they come here to Washington State. More often they go to Canada. One reason is the tax breaks they get there. That is changing now. British Columbia is cutting its film and TV tax breaks. Let's welcome Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. First of all, Vaughn, why does Hollywood love Canada and British Columbia besides the tax breaks?
Well, you know, we're such wonderful, friendly, happy people. Mm-hmm. Look, we've been at it a long time, and we've done pretty much everything we can to attract the industry. So there are tax incentives. There's a very cooperative government in terms of making locations available. There are film officers that help them find locations. There is government-funded studios. There's a lot of trained workers here. It's convenient being in the same time zone as Hollywood, so people can fly up here and fly back down. And as I say, Bill, because we've been at it for so long, we've got a very large stock of trained crews and technicians here. And a lot of producers have made movies and TV shows here, and they keep coming back because they know the market, they know the place. Our film unions have been really good, too. They've worked well together to make sure there are no obstacles to the production companies getting their work done on time and on budget.
The producers do keep on coming back. Will you remind us of a few of the recognizable titles?
Well, Deadpool, mm-hmm. Deadpool shot on, and it's a good example, too, of how cooperative they are here. So Deadpool, there is a very long stretch of that movie, is shot on the Granville and Georgia viaducts right next to downtown Vancouver. Well, the city of Vancouver just closed those two freeways for the duration for the producers. Of course, that one, we really liked the boost that we got from a British Columbia boy, a Vancouver guy, Ryan Reynolds being the star. And I believe it is now one of the top grossing R-rated films of all time and one of the big Marvel comic adaptations, too. So that one has been a real ad, but, you know, we've got the X-Men here. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention David Duchovny and the X-Files, which really put us on the map. But yep. So much stuff goes on here. I'll be seeing a movie all the time, Bill, and I'll go, you know, that looks suspiciously to me like downtown Vancouver. When you get to the credits at the end, sure enough, it was.
So that's all pretty cool. Why then would British Columbia want to take back tax credits?
It's amazing. I think it would be hard, as an example of how well the industry is doing here, $2 billion worth of business year before last, is the fact that the government announced this year that the tax credits were getting to be so onerous that the government wasn't sure it could afford them anymore and wasn't sure that they were needed anymore. The Canadian dollar is down. It provides a fairly large incentive for the industry anyway. And the tax credits, which were running at about $300 million just two or three years ago, were hitting $500 million Canadian this year. So the government said it was going to claw back some of that relief. The industry met with the government and went, yeah, okay, you know, yeah, you could do some of that. So the government is sort of taking back $100 million worth of credits. And the amazing thing about that is the industry leaders all came out and said, yeah, we can live with that, no big deal. In the past, you know, they threatened to take their productions elsewhere and go to, you know, North Carolina or Quebec or who knows, North Pole. This time they all said business as usual. I think they're all kind of locked in here. So the government says it'll be careful, Bill. They say if there's any sign that the industry is moving somewhere else or that productions are being taken elsewhere, it will act quickly to protect the industry. But this change, I think, has been accepted by the industry, and we go forward from here.
Okay, and not to the North Pole. Staying in Canada. Finally, Vaughn, we just have a minute.
Out there, Bill, and so are the tax breaks, is what we say here.
In the minute we have left, would you tell us what some B.C. lawmakers did here in Washington State?
We had two opposition members of the British Columbia legislature go down to Washington and Oregon to study your experiment with legalization in marijuana to get some ideas of what we can expect here in British Columbia. In Canada, our national government is going to be bringing in legislation. I guess the thing that really caught their attention was how much money the government is making off of it in Washington and Oregon. I think the British Columbia government will be urged to get a piece of the action, whatever happens. There are a lot of issues, though, as you know, with policing, impaired driving, and we'll be hearing more from our opposition party, too.
Thank you, Vaughn. That's Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer here on KUOW's The Record.